very much for having me over. So this talk is going to be slightly odd because a lot of it is still going on. As you see, it's still coming up. And it's related to several recent observations and some less recent observations. And depending on time, this talk is going to be sort of divided into two, maybe one part a little larger than the other. But in the first part, we'll be talking about the work I've been doing with Matt Bongard, Cliff Chang, which is actually visiting today, Charles Bruderman, Yan Taowan in Princeton. And the second part will be with a work I've done with Neil Weiner's making. All right, so this talk is going to be about dark matter, yeah? This is really old news. I think it was the first one who discovered it. It's already in 33. For the purpose of this talk, I'm going to take the most, in my mind, conservative approach, which is to assume that we have some newly interacting massive particle. Observationally, we seem to think it has a density, local density, of approximately 0.3 giga electron volt per centimeter cube. And the global density is well predicted. The thermal relative abundance is well predicted if you take a cross-section, an electric cross-section of this size. Okay, we'll see later on that this size actually plays a role in a few other observations. And there is a little dirty secret associated with those numbers. There are other news which are a little older, a little newer, but still pretty old. 1970, people observed positronium lines from the center of the galaxy. And already in 1970, Leventhal realized that if you take this as really coming from positronium annihilation, there are quite too many positrons annihilating the center of the galaxy. Of course, shouldn't be impressed by Fermi 42. I mean, there are way more particles than that. But if you take into account the other sources, the other extragalactic sources that can bring it, it seems to produce too many. So it's not clear where it's coming from. There are many suggestions. There are many astrophysical suggestions. But recently, Integral has sort of killed several of those suggestions. Integral shows that there is a very strong bulge component. So many of those positrons are actually coming from the bulge part of the galaxy in the center. And to explain that takes a little more. To explain why is it coming from the center and not from the disk itself takes a little more, and it kills all sorts of other ideas. All right, and the new thing is that Finkbeiner and Weiner suggested that maybe what's really going on is dark matter inelastically scattering and into a state which I call chi star and emitting the electron positron here. There should be an electron here. And the excited state then later on decays into an electron positron, and this is the source of the positronions. All right? So this is a diagram associated that I'd like to associate with this observation.
But isn't it the evidence for the dark matter kind of origin has weakened in the past year, because Integral published initially they have seen absolutely spherical random emission from the central region. Now they start seeing a symmetry in the blob, and there is a correlation with the standard astrophysical sources of this
symmetry. So it's still possible that it is astrophysical sources.
Let's put it this way. Yeah. After this year, it became more plausible than it was 3 years ago, right?
That's
what I'm saying. That the you know, if you try to interpret it as an evidence for dark matter, this evidence has weakened.
Right. So I will not, in this talk, I will not try to interpret this as the only evidence, but I will try to associate such a diagram with maybe at least part of those positrons. Okay. But as you'll see in a second, this is not going to be the only. I'm certain I'm taking this as evidence for dark matter. Related to maybe what you want to say also, that if you naively estimate this, the cross section for this is too small, but you have to take into account the ladder diagrams, if this is a, if what they exchange is a very light particles. And this does bring you to a cross section which is reasonably in agreement with this number of 10 to the 42.
Yeah, what happened in the version one of thin binary and lighter? They just
right.
took the cross section way above the inherent limit
right.
at small L, right? That's what happened. Right? And we right. pointed out that it actually has to be, you know, if you want to be consistent, you have to be in high L's.
Right.
Or have those, you know, some huge spike.
Right, so this is exactly what you just said, and all right. There are more recent news about from Dama Libra, and again, this is a very controversial observation that seems to be in disagreement with everyone else. In particular, if you look at the plot of cross section versus wink mass, they are totally excluded by CDMS and Xenon. But again, there may be a way out, there may be several ways out. To me, in my mind, the most compelling way out, for reasons I'll tell you a little later, is the idea of inelastic dark matter. And so this is the diagram associated with this process.
What is the vertical axis?
The vertical axis is a nucleon wimp cross-section, scattering cross-section. Right, so you see that if you assume elastic cross-section, the bound is a 10 to the minus 43 centimeter squared of wind scattering against the nucleon.
Still going down.
Still going down, yeah. But as well, I'll talk about that. And then there is the Hayes thin binary in 2003 took the CMB and reduced it. And eventually, when he fully reduced everything we know, he was left with a Hayes, which seems to indicate that. There is some synchrotron radiation from more positrons. And again, the diagram that would associate with that is actually on the next slide.
Why do you say positrons? What's the
electrons? Positron electron, Boltzmann synchrotron radiation. The most recent news, there is one more that is even more recent. In October 2008, the failed quantum matter exploration and light nuclear astrophysics, which should be pronounced PAMELA, has reported the sharp rise. And so this is all the data available. All those other experiments, previous experiments, including their previous run, and the red dots are their current run. The axis is energy scale versus fraction of positrons over the total positron plus electron content of the cosmic ray. And the expected behavior is a fall with energy, something that falls like, I think, the energy to the almost third power. But instead, you see a very sharp.
This is the ratio. The ratio is not going to fall as the energy to the third power. It's the flux that's pulling.
Yes, you're right. Thank you. So you see, it's around 10 GeV, you start seeing a rise in the ratio. And interestingly enough, if you look at their error bars, they're really pretty small. So unless there is some systematics going on, this seems to be a pretty clean measurement.
In the paper by these people, they refer to one paper by Moskalenko and Strong, published in 1998. And this short curve that comes from the secondary cosmic ray collision with Stoker, calculated in this paper.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too high, the energy too low, the energy too low, the high energy. So this paper was published in 1998.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the paper, it's very complicated. Mm-hmm. As far as I can tell, it's never been checked. It's 11 parameter solution to the problem. Someone should go in and check that paper before they start using the paper, I think.
So let me tell you one thing about this in one moment. I think in general, each one of those evidence by themselves are not that compelling, but if you take them all together, they have a fairly coherent picture with dark matter doing this. Okay, now, so in general, I completely agree. If you look at every one of those dimensions by themselves, there are maybe also physical sources, there may be other things going on. But if you take those observations as a whole, and you assume dark matter, it seems to work pretty well. And just recently, the NYU group actually combined all those things and trying to form a coherent picture. And there is a fairly coherent picture between Pamela and the thing I'm going to show next, which is epic. So maybe right that every one of those things may be explained by something else, but it seems they can all be explained by one thing, which is dark matter.
Yeah, but in this case, too, the recent papers as of 10 days ago show that the pulsars, nearby pulsars, can fit the data. Except for cakes.
Yeah.
Cakes come out of the dark matter annihilation. But we don't understand pulsars and we don't understand the astrophysics.
Right. That's true, but I would like to try to make progress. So maybe my progress is misguided, maybe those observations tell me nothing new about the high energy physics, but for now, let me assume that it does tell me sense.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Should I read something into the fact that the previous data mostly seems to be above the
formula? That's a good question. I've noticed that too. I don't know what the answer is. Yeah.
And slightly different
slope. It's like a different slope, yeah. So, yeah.
There must be normalization
there. I'll tell you something even more disturbing in a second about the ethic result. But as I said again, each one of those observations by themselves, as a particle physicist, which is my background, I would not believe it in a second. But if you take it as a whole, there seems to be something there. All right? And this is the picture I'd like to associate with this process. And that is of a dark matter annihilating into some gamma prime, which is some photon, massive photon, which couples to only dark matter. And that guy does nothing but decay into electrons. Okay, and if you look at the recent, this is from, I think it's from February, and they may have updated this in June. This is a plot from Jolis, Goodenough, and Weiner, which in a sense predicted this behavior when they took this process. And there are a couple of things to note here. I think you probably cannot see it, but what they have here is a 77 times 10 to the minus 26 centimeter square, which is essentially assuming a huge boost for this annihilation cross-section. And they claim that they achieve it through what is known as the Sommerfeld enhancement due to this very light boson. Okay, not in that paper, but in the more recent understanding is that this is not some boost factor, but just Sommerfeld enhancement of the cross. All right, so now for the really new stuff is ATIC. And what they look there is that they cannot distinguish between positrons and electrons. They just look at, leptons and protons, but they just have colorimeters and they see how much energy is deposited as the thing goes through. Electrons will deposit most of their energy in the beginning of the colorimeter. Hadrons will deposit almost nothing at the beginning and a little bit at the end. And this is how they hope to distinguish between the two. And again, they look at the energy spectrum and the flux. And sorry, let's go back to what you just mentioned. That is the flux that decays as the energy to the third power. And they theorize. Now, a couple of disturbing things about this plot. First of all, is if you look at the error bars, they're extremely small. In fact, even this curve, which is their fit to KK, seems to violate the data by several standard deviations. So it's a little odd why would they even fit that, because from their data, it seems that this is ruled out by several standard deviations. Now, granted, this is only systematics. Sorry, this is only statistics, so maybe there are systematic errors. But interestingly enough, there seems to be two shoulders here. There is one here in a plateau, and again, it rises and falls. All right? A second disturbing thing is that if you look at the background, there is a background coming from misidentified proton, misidentified photons, and yes, they say that the background is order of magnitude lower than the signal. But if you look at the shape of the background, it has the same shape to exactly produce this sort of behavior if it was a little higher. Okay, so I'm not claiming that it is wrong, I'm just saying that, again, as a part of the phase, when you see that your background does the same thing as your signal, you get a little
suspicious.
Yeah. All right.
The same goes about popular, at least I don't put a fraction of the positions of mistake positions. The whole reflex is going up. If there is a positive fraction, means that at some point you can see the rays rise in the ratio.
So it's a little disturbing. Maybe some of us it's more than a little disturbing. But let's see what we can do with that. Okay, so this is just.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
So the dashed line, what is the source of that?
The dashed line, I think, is just what you, if I'm not mistaken, the dashed line here is just what you expect from normal sources.
Which are.
This is secondary electrons that came out, and that's why the flux decays as some large power of unit.
The pulsars can fit that thing.
All right.
But there's no kink. It's smooth. You can't use the data.
I don't quite see why the pulsar. Okay, so the thing that you have to explain is why does this happen at this particular energy scale. For pulsars, you can do it because, yes, there is this rise, but you have to. What has to happen is the overall scale has to exactly match to start seeing this rise. But again, I'm not going to argue with you about astrophysics because I'm not an astrophysicist. All right? Yeah?
Does this experiment have any directionality? Can it determine where the things
are? No, not really.
And there is another important thing is that above this bump, right, there is apparently a break in the spectral behavior of the flux.
Right.
So it's a steeper flux.
From Hess, is that?
Yes.
Yes, and that's.
And that's, you know, that's more kind of disturbing.
Where is that published?
It's not published in the wrong archives, I think.
In the archive last year.
Sorry, because he showed that slide last night, the Hess result.
He came up one day last
year. That's what I was.
So, let me, this was our introduction, we're already a little late, so let me quickly tell you what I'm going to talk about if I have time. I'll tell you maybe some model buildings that needs to be done for producing the kind of diagrams that I mentioned. To me, the more interesting thing is maybe see if you have any strong collider signatures that can result from this. And the second part, I'll tell you a little more about things related to DAMAS, which is the other controversial experiments that we have. So. This paper came out a little while ago and contained, this paper sort of takes quite many ideas that were there in the literature before and tried to bring them into a coherent picture. So they don't have any new ingredients there really that hasn't been around, I think. Are you Maxim Postbaum? Yeah, so Maxim certainly had this before, had several of those things under different names. Neil Weiner and Fing Weiner, as I said, all mentioned those things. So, but this paper, the nice thing about it is it sort of gives a coherent picture, maybe what we think is maybe a coherent picture for all those signatures giving out those diagrams. So, as I said, the diagram I like to associate with Attic and Famella is this diagram. The diagram I'll associate with integral and case maybe something like this. Maybe even Dhamma, which is an inelastic scattering. Okay.
Are you sure that the Haze comes?
No, so
I thought Haze would.
You're right.
Synchrotron radiation from
that's
very energetic.
Yeah. No, as this flashed out, I was hoping no one was going to notice, but this is a mistake. This is not the Haze should be here, because what happens there is that you just produce a positron and they ramscal and. The synchrotron radiation. So yeah, this should just be associated with integral stuff.
But the difference is that Hale has got central galaxy, those are locally produced. Attic and Pamela are locally.
Right. Yeah. And the idea behind explaining all those diagrams is you have some TV dark matter charge under a non-Abelian gauge theory. And a non-Abelian gauge theory somehow weakly mixed, or some part of it, some Abelian part of it, is weakly mixed with the star model.
Yeah. So in this theory of dark matter, are there the same number of parameters as the data points, or are there more or less fewer?
So that's an excellent point. Right now, I think there isn't even an obvious match between what I'm going to present to you and the data. Okay, so I'll present to you some non-abelian theory, has some gauge coupling, has some masses, has some breaking. I don't even know if I actually take a particular point and really try to match the data, do I really get an agreement? I don't know the answer. That's not one thing I'm referring to.
I have a problem. Okay. In this new model, or my model, or whatever, you do two things at one step. Right? Once you drive down the mass of the mediator, you get the enhancement without any further fine tunings, and you cut out the anti-proton flux, which is there. Because if you produce the mediators that are sort of GV-ish or under, and then you cannot kinematically produce anti-protons, and there is a strong constraint on anti-protons. So you can sort of kill, you know, two things with one shot.
Yeah. And there are several other nice things. I'll just mention it. Maybe give you for example, if you look at the excited dark matter, it has a very nice explanation for why it was coming from the ball and not from the disk. And it's essentially because you have to go through this excited state, and you don't have enough kinetic energy in the disk to go to that excited state, and you do have it in the ball because the velocity and dispersion relation.
But there is no dark matter in the disk.
No. You think about as the halo as a whole. Why is it not?
Okay.
Why do you not see it coming from outside? And see
sure,
it?
Sure.
So this is another nice explanation that just comes out immediately from this.
So you're saying that if you take this model and put it into a Boltzmann collision or same body simulation package and run it, is there any interaction between the
No, but those interactions, the cross-section rate is extremely small compared to what you, what will cause things like interacting dark matter. When people talk about interacting dark matter, they're talking about nuclear cross-sections, not weak cross-sections. That's not so much the problem. The problem is that how will the fact that you can now go to the excited state and then can only later decay, change things. But so this I don't think has been done.
It hasn't been
put into NMR simulation. But what has been done? Let me tell you what has been done. Not taking this model, but taking the crude what Maxim was just talking about. Taking the crude idea of having some massive U1 and talking about the sizing.
Dark photon.
And right, a dark photon. A massive dark photon though. Taking that and trying to match that to ATIC and Pamela at the same time. This has been done and shown successful within order of magnitude. Within factor of two. Okay, so if you say, can I fit Pamela? Yes, I can. Does this fit also fit the attic for me? Yes, it does.
Yeah, but does it fit the halo of galaxy's rotation curve?
No, but what do you mean by that? I mean, this is dark matter. It has the same cross section. I'm assuming the same radic abundance. I'm assuming the same cross section. As normal, and that I can do. And this has already, of course, been incorporated. The only thing that's not been incorporated is you haven't taken that particular model which allows this sort of excitation and put it into N-body simulation. Mm-hmm. I don't see any real reason why it should change anything.
Well, but in the standard Navarro Fred White profile put into the N-body, there's a collision response, and it causes plus problems.
But again, John, that's not. That's just the N-body simulation without gas. So that's a very long discussion. I think maybe we should let him go on. So
let me just address some of the things that sound skepticism. So as I said already, it really depends which observation you believe. And again, Dama can be wrong. Those guys haven't really communicated with anyone else, so who knows what they're doing there. But we have their graphs. Now, general theory, if your theory explains all the experiments, it must be wrong, because some of the experiments are wrong. But that's not a very, maybe in my eyes, that's not a good way to make progress. So let me try to make progress by taking this a little seriously and asking what possible things we can see that will help us exclude it. Okay? This is Steve Weinberg. This isn't the first thing. Sorry, I should have erased that. I did not intend to have this actually, but anyways. The big deal. I was
you know, this is recorded and everybody knows that.
I don't know. No, I've heard this before, but it's too casual. Anyway, so what I'm going to assume is that there's some dark SU2 plus Q1 as the most minimal non-abelian theory that can do what I'm about to try to do. And in order to get the splittings I want, what do I want? I want some state which is MeV. So these two states are MeV. This is the excited dark matter. And these two states are what give me gamma. Okay, so this has to be a little lower. This has to be a factor of 10 smaller splitting. And there are many ways we can do it. In the paper we're trying to produce, we have a laundry list of ways you can do this with non-abelian theories. One simple way you can do it is radiatively generate the splitting and have a char choice that exactly does that. Because the difference between those two states is the coupling constant times the charge difference squared, the charge squared difference, and times the mass of your gauge volume. And that exactly produces the right scales. So here is an equation to what I just said. If you look at it, if we agree that our dark photon is at the GeV, maybe a little less than GeV, because we don't want it to decay to final, etc. Too much.
Why?
You can have it decay to some final, but the ratio between final decay to finals and muons shouldn't be too large, because otherwise you're not going to produce enough muons in the next. So pion shouldn't dominate or anything. It should definitely not go into raw or other kind of hadrons.
You mean just by spectral information?
Yeah.
Or
just by how many electrons and muons I need.
For the big pion, so maybe essentially eventually be the positive
ones. Oh no, but
that's the muons decay.
Right, but that will produce more soft.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
By just fitting to the spectrum.
Right. So if you ask how does the soft spectrum looks like, having too many pions will destroy the soft agreement. Right. So if you take this number and you take alpha prime to be roughly fine structure constant, you get an MeV between these two states. And if you choose the hypercharge to be half minus some small number, you can get the ratio between you can get the ratio between those two splittings to be as small as you want. I want it to be 1/10. So that's easily done.
Do you say?
Yeah.
SU2 plus U1 is proportional to U1 UEM.
Right. So I mean the dark UEM.
Because the photon is massless in SU2.
Right. So what I'm imagining here is that I want to convince you that I can get this splitting in this limit. Then I'll turn a small mass for that dark photon. Okay, but this is just to illustrate that it's not hard to produce such splitting. But eventually, I really want to break the entire gauge group.
So you have to have a Higgs mechanism.
That's what I'm going to do. And that's not trivial. Yeah, I need a dark.
I can believe that.
Yeah. It's not too hard, but sure in a second. Now the other important thing is not just to generate a splitting, but you have to make sure that they are properly linked. Because if you just have a splitting and it won't decay, it won't do the excited dark matter story, that's not going to be very helpful. So let me just first tell you how to mix with the SNAM model. This was actually first pointed out by Bob Holden at UFT like almost 30 years ago. And you can write in your Lagrangian the coupling between our photon and the dark photon. And that will induce a mixing. What it will do is if you unmix it, it will charge anything that in the star model is charged under EMM will now also be slightly charged under this dark EMM. But not vice versa, that's important because we don't want dark matter to be charged under our EMM. That's not good. So it will produce this sort of coupling, and this is precisely what causes the thing to decay once you produce the dark photon. Okay, but it's a little more complicated than that. So this diagram will account for things like Pamela and Attic when you have the annihilation producing two of those guys, and then two of those guys goes to positron electrons. Okay, so we're there. We have that. But if we want to explain integral as well, we need to have some excited state decay into the dark matter and again producing positrons and electrons. So whatever I'm doing here better be neutral on the Sun model. And for that, I really need to not just to break the gauge symmetry, but break it completely and mix it. So this is the SU2 plus U1 dark mass matrix. And it has to be completely mixed. Those three things have to be different from each other, otherwise you can rotate the mixing away. The different masses have to be different from each other, otherwise you're not breaking charge. So it's a little bit of a mess. Breaking charge is not hard. Any stupid scalar will do that. But you really need to break a Stoddard symmetry as well. Okay. Now, I'm not going to go further on with the model building because I'm going to make all of you fall asleep. But I'll just tell you two words. First of all, if you think about the context of normal field theory, no supersymmetry, this is really pretty easy. There are many ways of doing it. I can just write down the scalar potential that does that. To break a Stoddard, hypercharge break a Stoddard, so I can use those couplings at loop level. So that's pretty easy. If you do supersymmetric model building, it gets a little harder because in supersymmetry, it's not trivial to write potentials that really breaks charge. You need to introduce quite a few other components. But again, it can be done, and it's part of a longer list that you can compile.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Why do you want chi star to be different from chi?
Because I want to produce those soft positrons for integral.
He wants an on-shell decay, right?
I mean, you couldn't just think of a Bremsstrahlung?
No, it's too small.
Kind of small?
Yeah. So this does not even have to be on-shell. This can be a GUV, and this can be MEV. But it's enough so that I can have this state has to be MEV, splitting between this and that, to produce these soft positrons. If you are disgusted by this part, you can just ignore it. You don't have to believe it.
I will.
Perfectly fine. For now, I'm just going to take it because it will help me explore what is my parameters. But as I said, Okay, so let me just tell you a little bit about collider signatures.
So can I ask you something?
Yeah.
So does this tie in Dharma with this integral?
Yeah.
So you can get the same model can be explained both.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Well, qualitatively. Different states.
Let me just say, this is not the state that explains Dharma. It's too heavy. This is an MEV splitting. For Dharma, you need 100 kV splitting. Let me go back to below.
You get three state dark.
Right. And for an SU2, you can just take a triplet of states. And one of them is a dark matter, one of them is 100 kV, one of them is a MEV.
Okay. So if you just have a U1, not the SU2, you would be able to...
Not going
to
work. This is not even going to work. I'm not going to be able to decay. I'm not going to be able to break charge in the right way. I can give the photon a mass, but I'm not going to break charge. There is still a global charge defined in the filter.
No, but if you have a double charge gate, you can only...
Sure. Because then you're really emitting a Higgs. Okay, so let me just tell you the collider signatures. Interestingly, so Maxim actually just recently published a paper trying to see if you can find this in experiments that have already been done. Essentially, this is an MGB particle. We don't need the LHC to get to this energy scale. We can just take positron electron, collide them, and produce this sort of thing, right? The problem is that you need to do it a lot because there is a suppression due to the mixing. And we just haven't produced that many events almost anywhere to do that. There are a couple of places, and I think Maxim can sure tell us more. I think you mentioned one possibility is the hyper-CP, where they see an actual peak at 214 MeV.
Generate myself.
Yeah.
It is the experimental collaboration that suggested that there is a resonance there at 314.
Oh, sure. So this is not new. This hyper-CP peak is, I think, 6 or 7 or 8 years old, and people have discussed this possibility that it's a resonance. But I think what you investigated is actually is that this is coming from this U1. Because previously, I thought in the literature, people actually saying that this cannot be a gate, it cannot be a vector boson. It's excluded by FCNCs from KDK, but you show that actually it's not. It's not
because they missed that not really they missed that the only radiative decays of K and sigma are all dominated by short distance effects. And so the new physics in this case is also because it goes through the traversal gamma, and the analysis was done with short distance effects,
right.
So it doesn't really.
Right. So there's this possibility, but so far nothing. Nothing that really seems to show this parameter has come up. So let me talk about what might happen in the LHC. One way to produce it is we're going to produce a lot of photons in the LHC, just from photons. And you have proton-proton. What's really happening is you have a quark and a gluon coming in. They exchange a quark and emit a jet and a photon. Right? This is the jet. This is the craft that comes out. And you have a photon coming in this way. If you have a photon coming that way, I can mix it with a dark photon. A dark photon can decay and produce those lepton jets. Okay, so one thing that a dark photon wanted to do for me is to produce leptons. Now, if I'm really in the minimal scenario where this dark photon really only decays the two leptons, you're dead. You're not going to see anything. There is a huge background from JSI and K and pi. In-flight decay, so that's not going to happen. But if that dark photon maybe decays into other things in that dark sector, because it's an unabelian theory, there are several other states in that sector, then maybe you can see more of those, because the end product have to be leptons, right? Because that's the lighter states, and they do mix it. So sooner or later, they will decay into leptons. So this is the hope, that something that will happen in the LHC. And you can ask why the cross-section for that. It's pretty tiny. So these are two curves. One of them is assuming two different branching ratios. The reason why the branching ratio is important is because if you want to be conservative, the only thing you're going to trigger on are muons. Electrons are pretty dirty. So if you have muons which are 3 GeV and above, they'll trigger on them. They'll record that event. And if you look at that cross-section, if you want a high PT, so you have more handles, you get the cross-section, which is, this is like 10 to the minus 3 picobarn. So really a femtobarn. The LHC, after maybe a few years of running, when it starts running, will produce a couple of inverse femtobarns every year. Later on, it will produce much more. So you can start seeing a couple of events like that in the very early stage of the LHC. Once it reaches high luminosity, maybe you can produce a lot of those. The problem is, of course,
generally, your femtobarn signals are
kinetic. Not really. I mean, it depends what you believe is your reach. I mean, the first year integrated luminosity is a couple of femtobarns. Later on, they hope to have 10 inverse femtobarns per year. Later on, they want to have 100 inverse femtobarns per year. That's we're talking about hundreds of events. So that's what I'm about to say, that those events are very particular, right? You have really boosted bunch of leptons coming this way and a jet on the other side, a drone activity on the other side. Right? So this is nothing like what you have in the star mode. You don't have, what you do in the star mode is a JSI production will produce two leptons and maybe some soft stuff. So you can cut on that quite a lot by just isolation cuts. It requires that there's no drone activity around those leptons. But you're not going to see other leptons. Also, you're not going to see other leptons around. Okay, here I'm requiring to have like something like 4 leptons coming into the detector bunched together. The real problem, I think, is that if you look at what is the resolution, what is the opening angle of those leptons, it's 10 millirad. So it's really tiny because it's essentially the opening angle is 1 over gamma, the boost of that thing. And it's
getting resolved, right?
Right. So the resolution for a single hit is a milliradian. Okay, so 10 times better than that. That's for a single hit. I don't know yet, and that's one thing we're working on right now. I don't know yet whether if you have a bunch of them hitting together, whether there's no electromagnetic spillage that will totally destroy your resolution. All right, so it's possible that you actually cannot really resolve so many muons, and then you cannot really tell when there are that many muons. But to begin with, it looks sort of hopeful because they're all pretty energetic. This is that distribution of the lepton energy for the four in the event. And you see they're all pretty energetic. I mean, they trigger on 3 GeV muons. So here we're talking about tens of GeV. This has a large cross section. This has a femtomark cross section. All right? So again, this is what you can do with the most minimal model. And I haven't said the word nanobillion at all. Well, I've said it once when I talked about a lot of space. You can also have supersymmetry in this way, again, speculative, and it sounds a little crazy because, you know, how are you going to start talks if you really want to talk about this thing? So first, you have to explain the Stan model, then you have to tell that maybe there is the minimal supersymmetric Stan model because of all sorts of other esoteric problems. Then you have to explain that maybe you have some dark sector, which is also supersymmetric. It gets pretty complicated, but we're going to at least try to say whether there is something that you can do now that you couldn't do before with this sort of sector. And one thing that was impossible to do before is to measure LSP production. If you have two LSP proton-proton coming in, two LSPs coming out, the only way to trigger a photon event is if you have initial state radiation of some hard gluon and you trigger on a single jet and then try to measure the missing PT. But now you can do more than that. You have this, you produce your sound model LSP. And that thing trickles down to the dark sector. The dark sector has to give you leptons at the end of the day, so it does. And this is how the event will look like. You'll have several very hard lepton jets and missing ET. Now, that thing is pretty easy to trigger on. That will have no problem triggering on it. What can you do with it? The cross section for that is pretty large, at least at the LAC. This is Pico Barn. Right, so if the sparks are at 500, you have quite a bit of cross section. That's 25 femtobarns. And so you can produce those things and see those events, and you can even reconstruct the LSP mass. Okay, if you just take all those, you take all those lepton jets, you take it together, you form their invariant mass, you plot it, and you'll see an edge which corresponds to the LSP mass.
Sentence as to why it's triggering so easy on these multi-jet events.
You have
a lot of multi-jet events, right? So what is it about this signal that?
So to trigger all those events is easy just because you have to have high PT, right? Their PT is just determined by the mass on the LSP, which has to be around 100 GeV or so. So you have very energetic leptons coming in. Now you have on each side several leptons and missing ET. What stun hole do you have for that?
Okay, and this is built into the trigger system? Because you would need to put this in.
No, this is already in the trigger. So triggering
on the missing energy in the first place?
For something like that, to trigger on that, you don't even need the missing energy. Just the fact that they have high PT muons is enough for them to trigger. If you have, they have triggers, things like a dime muon trigger for each muon is where it's a 3 GeV. Single muon trigger is something like 10 GeV. So triggering that is not a problem. Background is slightly more of an issue, but what background do you have for that in this problem? All right, so let me not bore you further with this sort of thing. Let me just quickly tell you in the last 10 or 15 minutes of the talk, let me tell you about Dhamma. Okay? So if you are totally unconvinced by what I just said, let me unconvince you even more. By talking about Dhamma. So what is Dhamma? Here is the annual modulation. This is the amplitude of the modulation. And they see a rise between 2 and 6 kilo electron volt equivalent. So this is not the actual energy. This is the energy measured, which is a little different. But they think they can calibrate for that. There's some controversy about this. The problem is that CDMS excludes it. CREST, which is turned out to be more interesting for us, excludes it. Although, if you look carefully, there are a couple of events. Actually, more than a couple. There are about 6 events They do see it, but they cannot really distinguish from background, so they just say background. Xenon excludes it even better. You see, the region that they care about for elastic scattering is the low energy region, and they don't see any events here. They see several events here, and by the way, this is where the fact that they don't see events here, this is the reason why the bound is so good, because the fact that they don't see something here already tells you something about the process, elastic process. But they do see events here. Some of them they tag as they understand this background, but there are other parts here that they don't understand. And if you look more carefully, there are tons of events outside of their experimental window. Okay? And you can say, yeah, sure, because they were smart. They knew where not to look, so they didn't look at where there's a hard background. But, you know, when you look at it carefully, it's not clear that this region is much more productive than this region. So there are quite a bit of events on this side. Now, I'm not going to argue with the first.
They took this cut prior to seeing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So this is. No, but my point is not that you should believe those events. My point is that inelastic predicts exactly events in this region and not in this region. Okay. So if you want to claim, for example, if they didn't see anything here, I would be very worried about inelasticity. But the fact that they do see things here actually tells you that you cannot exclude this possibility. But you're absolutely right. This is a blind analysis, so there's no cheating. Which cannot be said about Dhamma. Anyways, this is the exclusion plot, 10 to the minus 43, excluded for the elastic cross section. Now, the idea of inelasticity is that actually the elastic transition, which is often what people think of, is excluded or highly suppressed, and the only thing you're allowed is inelastic transition. The reason why this is good is because for this to happen, you need some minimum velocity. So you have this nuclear target sitting here at rest in the lab frame. The wimp is zooming by, colliding it, and inelastically scattering. But for this to happen, that wimp has to come with this minimum velocity, which is given by this formula. And you see here that the epsilon is the excitation energy. It's the difference between those two states. All right. So for very high... of course, this completely decoupled. Once those states become very separated, you'll never see this transition, you'll see no signal. And if it's too low, you're back to the elastic region, you're excluded by CDMS. So there needs to be some choosing between them. So here is the curve. If you can understand all of this specifically just from that simple formula. You draw the energy recoil, which is what they measure, versus the minimum beta. Here is the velocity of the wimp in the halo. This line is what is actually not as good as we don't really know where it is. There is a large uncertainty there, order 10-20%. But let's draw it anyway, just to explain it. There is an experimental range you can probe for the recoil energy, right? And you see that if this this is what they can observe. This is the regions they have for them to see events. Okay. If they go to a heavier target. Right? This is what happens with this curve, and now you have a much bigger window. Essentially, it's just because in the center of mass frame, you have a much heavier target, so you have much more momentum for the reduced system, and you can easily scatter into the inelastic state. Okay? The problem is that, so this gives a few interesting things. First of all, light element experiments like CDMS, which is germanium, will not see anything. The spectrum of events has a maximum, so it's not just the inelastic transition, which just speaks towards low recoil energy. And that has to do with what I mentioned before, that they do see events in the middle section, not in the beginning. And the interesting thing is that you're probing the Boltzmann distribution, so there could be large modulation. Another big criticism for against Dhamma was that your modulation is too large, dude, right? Your elastic transition will never give you such modulations. So how can you see that? But this might explain it. All right? So, excitation energy, if this curve, of course, becomes more and more like the elastic transition as I decrease the excitation energy, and it goes away as I increase epsilon. So, epsilon, this excitation energy has to be very carefully chosen. And this is part of the problem. Why the excitation energy have to have anything to do with the kinetic energy of wind in the halo? Those two scales have nothing to do with each other a priori, and they have to be equal to 100 kV. Now, in this scenario that I just told you about, I will not talk about it anymore, but this scale is actually very easily explained, and it's not a coincidence. Okay? But here I'd like to talk about something a little different, a different possibility for why this is so, and also that explains why the elastic channel is absent. Because even if you can concoct this sort of splitting, you still have to explain why you don't have elastic transition. It's not too hard, but you still need to do that. So one possibility is that there is some density of states. In fact, there are many, many, many excited states. And you can excite the transition to any of them. But if there are many more excited states at high energies than there are at low energies, you'll preferentially be excited to the high energy states. Okay? So something like that will work. And there is some new scale that in principle will be much larger than 100 keV, and so I no longer time my theory to 100 keV. There's nothing in my theory that says particular 100 keV. Okay? So the excitation energy is just determined by the highest energy available for you, that is just the kinetic energy in the halo. That explains it immediately. And the elastic scattering is state space suppressed. You just have many more states of high energies. Okay, let me not bore you with this. This is just how we just convolve this density of states against the normal rate computation. And you can define the overall scale. Let me not go over it. There is an overall scale associated with the problem because Dama has some cross section associated with it, which is a dimensionful quantity. So you cannot avoid the fact that there's some overall scale in the problem. So you can write the feed Dama. The problem is that if you try to do it with a very low density of states, of course the elastic transition is not suppressed enough. So first of all, you are excluded by CDMS, but also you don't feed Dama very well. This is the modulation point, and this is the fitting. This is the fit curve with the density of states with n equal to 3. But you can do it with a much higher density of states, something that grows at the ninth power of the energy. And interestingly enough, you find your wing does not have to be that heavy to do that. This is the spectrum. So again, this is what you'll see in germanium and tungsten, which is what Prest is, and the xenon spectrum. So this is a little comparison. You see that this is the density of states, how quickly it's going. You can see already here that the low density of states is totally excluded by CDMS and xenon, but the high density of states is perfectly fine, and the strongest tension is actually with Crest. The reason why strongest tension with Crest is because Crest is a very heavy target. It's tungsten, which is much heavier than iodine. So, but it's not excluded, it's borderline, and because Crest do see events. Right. So we can do that with a steep density of states. Let me not talk too much about that. There is clearly a strong coupling problem in this theory. So let me just start to give you a few examples where you do have such high density of states, and I'll finish here. Extra dimensions is one of them. If you have the number of states grows with the number of extra dimensions. In general, you can do it for any kind of manifold. Bound states, which is another example, maybe dark matter is some bound state. For example, the harmonic oscillator, we know how the energy goes there and the number of states. If you have harmonic oscillator in three dimensions, the number of states grows as the third power of the energy. Okay, so if I have more than that, I can increase the power. But you cannot be so cavalier about it because you have selection rules. Right, you cannot excite an n equal to 0 state to an n equal to 1 state with a scalar. So really, you don't have this D if you take into account selection. But you can consider a string. A string will have a higher power. Instead of energy to the 1 power, you have energy to the 3 half. And you can go further. You can use this theorem that tells you how many bound states you have. And for a very, very shallow potential, you can get energy density that grows as strong as you would like. Sounds crazy, but I think there is one example where I can think of, although I haven't worked it out, so I'll be happy to be proven wrong. But if you have a flat potential, had to begin with. There is no scale dependence, and you look at one loop level, you get a logarithmic potential which will do the job. Because if you have a logarithmic potential, you have exponential number of states. All right, so there's definitely many missing pieces. For example, why is the cosmology of such a win? Can this have any relation to material dark matter and the strong scale that I mentioned? But fortunately, this will soon be excluded. Right? There is more zero experiments underway. Zero and 100 should be able to exclude it unless they cannot defeat their background. Because right now, the only reason why it's not excluding it is because of background. But CREST should have better bounds very soon. They just published their commission run results, and it's already borderline, so maybe already excluding that. All right, so I'm right on time. Let me just conclude then that new observation, which you are free to disbelieve, I think do warrant some ideas, some initial construction of some sort of concordance models. And by the way, the reason maybe this is a good thing to do right now, if the LHC was on, I won't be talking about that. But the LHC is not going to be on for 2 years. So
2 years?
Yeah, I think so. The official thing is like a year.
Depends whether they go with plan A or plan B.
What?
Depends which group they take. As far as I know, they can decide.
Right, so it depends whether they have, so they have to see what happens to the pressure valves. Pressure valve did not, as far as I know, did not act as it should have and release the
design flaw.
And so it's a question of whether it's a design flaw, in which case they'll have to redesign it and replace everything. That was 2 years. Mm-hmm. Or they can just retune it a little bit and reinstall it. And that's a year. I would conservatively assume 2 years. But I don't know. I don't have any basis for this statement, except for the fact that you do have to redesign it and install it. So it's a good time for me to think about that. Some preliminary generic predictions for the LHC are I think, what I showed. I'm not sure if there is much more because there's just no other way to produce it. And Dama may give us a hint that dark matter is a complicated composite type of state. But very broadly speaking, if you believe integral or if you believe Dama, that means that dark matter has another scale in it aside from the electroweak scale.
Can I interject?
Yeah.
Gamma claims the signal. An integral sees the line, does not claim its dark matter, right? It reports the line and the TV.
Right.
You cannot say in one sentence, if you believe integral and of course we believe integral. It's a beautiful 500 little feeling line. Right?
However, let me remind you that Gamma acronym is dark matter. So it's not surprising they actually claim that this is dark matter. But what you want to do with it, that's a different story. Yes,
I'm saying that the integral doesn't claim any dark matter signal.
So, again, I'm not going to press this point more than I have not pressed this point. You can disbelieve integral completely. But if you do believe some of it, there is some other scale in the problem that warrants some consideration. All right, thank you very much.
I was just wondering if you have looked at the inelastic collisions with energy release, because lots of these particles, as you went from colliding in the galaxy, right, and some of them are in the excited state, and they can go down in energy to a lower state in your experiment and release energy. Right?
That's a very good point. So in general, you need to consider what is the Maxwell Boltzmann distribution of those. If you really have all those states,
suppose when one takes this really serious to this model of three states and you can calculate probably the point is that the second state, right,
yeah,
will be more populated than the third state,
right,
for obvious reasons.
That's right.
And when it comes to your apparatus, can happily scatter in germanium and would go down to the lower state with the 100 kV energy.
Absolutely. So
why has
we have not done that yet. No. Almost none of the.
That is an incomplete analysis. Right?
Absolutely. That's why I said this is an incomplete talk. Yeah. That's why it's work in progress. Absolutely. You need to consider that. You need to consider, just in general, what is the population of excited state versus
and how they decay.
And how they decay, yeah. For example, the NUV excited states has a very long lifetime.
Well, KV, 100 KV will be
even longer, absolutely. So there are things to consider, and maybe in a few weeks we decide that this is just already ruled out. Not quite so sure it's ruled out then, but yes, there are those constraints.
I can't help be suspicious about the fact that the Dharma modulation is due to something to do with the solar system. There can be also some boring explanations.
So they have finally provided their temperature dependence. And that is not from what they provide, that does not seem to be the explanation. But of course, they have a vested interest in it, so I'm not so sure whether you can believe that.
Somebody else.
Yeah, so that's what I said, that very soon Crest should be able to exclude this in elastic dark matter.
When are they
going to
report?
Not sure. The one in 2008 is a commission from. Or not too soon. The real problem, Zeno, as I said, Zeno should already exclude this because Zeno is actually a little heavier than iodine. But the problem is that they have enormous backbone. They have 20 advanced charges back. So they're now scaling it up to Zeno, which is 150 kilograms. But the question is whether they're going to be able to beat the backbone. If they're not, then...
Are they also in grand system?
Yeah.
That's
some, right? Yeah. So you have xenon in grand system, you have precedence in grand system, and you have gamma in grand system.
These are going to move to a small lab, right? It's a lower neutron factor.
The Zeppelin, which is another experiment, is in England, I believe. And Kings, which also does... Kings is the closest one to down, because Kings does cesium iodine. So in principle, you're scattering against the same target, but they don't have enough data. It's in Korea. We're not going to have to wait 2 years to know the answer.
All right, any final questions?
Do we have to wait more than 50 years to know whether dark matter exists?
I think, from everything I've seen and read, I'm convinced that it's there. No other explanation. Why? Because you have now so many evidence. You have the CMB, you have rotation cures, you have bullet cluster, you have rotational lensing, you have what else? Let's see. What am I forgetting? I think I'm forgetting another one, but there are now multiple evidence that this is not anything but.
Read my paper.
All right, with that, I guess we'll thank you.